the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California. This is Flashpoints. I'm Dennis Bernstein. Today on the show, Emmy Award-winning filmmaker John Pilger joins us for more on Julian Assange and Russiagate. Maybe I should say Mullergate. Also, we'll look at Trump's collusion with extreme right-wingers in the U.S. to steal your vote. And Professor Stephen Kinzer on the long history of U.S. intelligence agencies meddling in the affairs of foreign governments and also overthrowing them. All this coming up straight ahead. Stay tuned. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Again, we're honored to have back with us the eminent Emmy Award-winning filmmaker, John Pilger. Made many extraordinary films. It all started somewhere around Southeast Asia when he began to document the slaughter that the U.S. was leading against the Vietnamese people that cost them so many lives and countries in the region, incredible suffering, and he has been going from there. Today, John joins us again to talk about the brutal treatment and arrest of Julian Assange. John, welcome back to Flashpoints. Maybe begin. This report came out today. Any kind of gut reaction before we jump into more important things?
The report, the Mueller report.
The Mueller thing, yeah.
Yeah. I have to tell you, as I'm sitting in the morning in Sydney, Australia, I have not yet had a chance to look at it in close, Dennis, but my view on, as I think you rightly described, the Mullergate situation is that... is to ask the question, when is some semblance of a proper political discourse going to return to the United States instead of heading down these cul-de-sacs of nonsense about Russia and and those who have conspired allegedly with Russia to overthrow American democracy. We've seen within the last week an expression of modern democracy in Julian Assange being dragged out of the Ecuadorian embassy in London to face a court in which the judge abused him on the basis of no evidence whatsoever and then sent him off to a top security prison. That alone, I think, is an expression of what has happened to liberal democracies in recent years.
All right, let's talk let's make this a real reality sandwich. The reason why Julian Assange is now in a maximum security prison is because he provided a way for people to remain anonymous while revealing some of the most crucial information that has everything to do with the way we live, the way we relate to each other across borders and around the world. And but it didn't look good for the powers that be in the United States and Great Britain and other places. That's what's going on here, right?
You're right. Yes, that's exactly what's going on. And I think what we who have followed this situation for now a number of years really have a responsibility to remind people of the achievements on their behalf of WikiLeaks, the public service performed by Julian Assange, going back 9 years, the shocking disclosures of war logs from Iraq and Afghanistan, the assassination of civilians in Afghanistan, 66,000 people labeled by the U.S. military as civilians killed. The numbers really are just extraordinary. And WikiLeaks is revealing of the true nature of U.S. colonial wars, and of course, as you rightly say, backed by its allies such as Britain in Afghanistan in particular. But the release of State Department cables that showed the massive surveillance of diplomats in the United Nations by the United States, the release of cable showing that how the United States was up to its ears in the 2009 coup against President Zelaya in Honduras, overthrew him, in fact. Even here in Australia, the cables that have shown how the Prime Minister Kevin Rudd was removed from office following objections by the United States to a very modest proposal of his to ease off the anti-China campaign and to accommodate something of China's rise in the Asia Pacific. What those cables revealed were protected sources, as they describe, in the U.S. Embassy here. Protected sources turned out to be members of Parliament. And so it goes on, Dennis. I think it's worth mentioning that when we're talking about achievements, in January 2011, WikiLeaks released documents that showed the extent of the corruption of the Ben Ali regime in Tunisia, and probably were at least partly responsible for a mass movement beginning in that country that toppled that dictatorship, which had been in power for decades. And of course, on it went to Egypt. WikiLeaks described, its cables described the extent of the outrages in Guantanamo. They're known as the Guantanamo Files, documenting the illegal imprisonment of at least 150 Afghan and Pakistani civilians. WikiLeaks released the Syria files, which exposed the activities of 90 major surveillance companies, and so on. I can go on. I think it's terribly important that we remind your listeners who, understandably, like myself and undoubtedly like yourself, become almost trapped in the vortex of instant news. With all kinds of ill-founded accusations going backwards and forwards about Assange, just why he was forced into the Ecuadorian embassy in London, why the U.S. wants to get its hands on him, why he was arrested so brutally, because he has lifted investigative journalists to a level of revelation that gives us all much more than a glimpse. It gives us a real insight into how unaccountable power works, that unaccountable power which calls itself a democracy.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're speaking with filmmaker, journalist, investigative reporter, human being, John Pilger, and we're talking about a lot of inhumanity and unnecessary suffering, and I guess the suffering that needs to happen if these powers continue to rage war and want to make sure that they have the go-ahead and no opposition to as much weaponry as they want to produce, as many wars as they want to fight, and life goes on. These are, John, they leave me speechless. There is a traffic jam between my heart and my brain because, you know, you and I have been alive a while, and we were looking for the curve up. And this one, you know, this one is a setback. This one could lead us to World War III.
Well, that's true. I suppose if one applies the glass half full philosophy to that thought, Adenas, the fact that WikiLeaks has been able to let us know so much about our world and to give us the words, an arsenal of a political arsenal to fight what you rightly describe as a war. We have been in the midst of a kind of world war since 9/11. It was going on before that, of course, but there was perhaps something of a pause after the official end of the first Cold War. But since 9/11, the so-called war on terror has a war of terror, which has seen the deaths of millions of mostly Muslim people around the world, the attacks on countries from Iraq to Yemen to Somalia, the threats against countries, the sanctioning, so-called, of countries, the absurdity of the misuse of power, such as the United States president deciding he will decide who is going to be the president of Venezuela. These events add up to a war against the very principles, and I think this is really the nub of all of this, Dennis. The principles that were set up following, that were enacted into institutional life, however imperfectly, following the Second World War. Those principles came out of a war in which millions died, in which the Holocaust happened. And at that time in history, people of vision and many, many millions of people, with many, many millions of people supporting them, said, this is not going to happen again, never again. We're going to set up a real structure, a framework in the world that allows this not to happen again. And of course, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and so many bodies in the highly imperfect United Nations that attempted to enact those principles. And international law, which really hadn't existed before the Second World War, international law became something that the majority of humanity thought was a good idea. Those principles have been thrown away. International law has been ripped up. That's what's at stake here. It's about right and wrong. It's about the law. And I think there are many ways to distract us from this, and we could be here talking all day about all of them. But that's the nub of it.
I agree with you, John Pilger. And, of course, it's always important to keep that at least one eye on the prize, which is, the empowerment of the people by informing them, giving them the information they need to make the decisions that determine their life and their happiness or not. And that's really the battle. That's the job of the journalist, right? To monitor the powers and make sure people understand the context, how things are happening, what's going on. Julian Assange, and I think, John, the thing that really gets to me is that so many of these major news organizations who used his work because they knew it was absolutely dependable and correct have somehow forgotten. There's a few throwaways about, oh yeah, well, if they can do it to him, maybe they'll be able to do it to us. But I really want people to speak out about this, because there is a great deal at stake. And what I saw is journalists becoming prosecutors, not if you will, collaborators, supporters of the people in the field who are putting everything on the line to tell the truth, to speak truth to power. And Julian Assange created such a effective structure in WikiLeaks for doing this, for protecting his sources. So it really became an important part of the publishing world, if you will. I'm going on here, John, but you know what I'm saying.
Yes, I do. I think he represents, I mean, Julian is, I think, the last person really who would want himself to be regarded as some sort of cult hero. And he is an heroic figure. There's no question about that. What he did and what WikiLeaks did is bring out of the shadows all the great the work of whistleblowers. That's why Daniel Ellsberg is so interesting and so eloquent in his support for Julian Assange. Daniel Ellsberg is, of course, one of the pioneers of the sort of whistleblowing that WikiLeaks represent, the kind of work that Chelsea Manning did and that Julian oversaw. And I think serious journalists, and I have to say, and I don't think I've used this term before, but moral journalists know that the basis of great disclosure journalism is a whistleblower, is what Julian described as a conscientious objector within a system. You know, we as journalists, investigative journalists, if you like, depend on the courage and resourcefulness and risk of the whistleblower. That has been true for as long as there has been a printing press, some of the early whistleblowers against the church suffered very badly for their so-called indiscretions. If you, for example, read Philip Knightley's book on war reporting, the First Casualty. It's a litany, actually, of journalists really just being the ventriloquists of power, except for the mavericks. And the mavericks are those who are in league, if you like, with the whistleblowers, those who went to Vietnam and who listened to soldiers who were prepared to speak out or prepared to speak quietly and secretly about the true nature of that war. We've always depended on whistleblowers. You mentioned earlier the hypocrisy of some of these news organizations. I mean, they've made hypocrisy almost, it's you couldn't call it an art form, but hypocrisy used to be something, a human, let's say, moral disability that we would think of as slightly exotic. Not anymore. It is the system. And perhaps it's good that we now realize that these so-called news organizations, and they're not really, they're propaganda organizations, are driven by hypocrisy. There's a lot for people perhaps to take in and understand today, but I don't think it's all that difficult. It is about telling the truth. It is about the facts. I interviewed in a film I made a few years ago Professor Stuart Ewan in New York, and it's a wonderful interview. I really appreciated what he said, and he talked about how facts don't matter anymore. It's the perception that matters. That is a confidence trick on us all, and that is at the core of modern media. Perception, not truth.
Yeah.
Perception, not facts. And the facts do matter. The truth does matter. That hasn't changed. That's always been the case.
That is absolutely true. We're speaking with John Pilger. We're talking about Julian Assange. We're talking about the way he's been treated and the contribution that WikiLeaks continues to make, has made through this struggle, which is also incredibly impressive in terms of staying focused on what really matters. So we're glad that this is that there is the will and the power, and that a structure was created so that it could continue. But I do think, you know, the bottom line is that it is time for everybody who really considers themselves a journalist or believes in truth telling or wants to support the, if you will, a phrase I like to use, the canary in the coal mine of corporate disinformation and government disinformation. Now is the time to lock arms. Final comments, John.
Yeah, I think that's puts it well, Dennis. But I think we have to perhaps face the fact that the so-called corporate media, I'm sorry to use a biblical term, but is really so much of it. It's just beyond redemption. Why do journalists behave the way they do? Well, because they're seduced into a system very easily. Also, they don't want to lose jobs. There's an enormous insecurity now. They don't want to lose jobs, and if they did go against a system on a newspaper, the New York Times, the Guardian. I know in my own case, I used to write for the Guardian, and then I started to write some of the things that the Guardian didn't particularly agree with or want. And that was soon followed by my demise from the Guardian. So those systems exist. And I think it's the responsibility for all of us to support programs like yours that circumvent this this almost this organized forgetting, this organized lying, that we have to now create in the West a kind of what they used to describe in the Soviet Union as a samaza, an underground media. We have to educate people to read between the lines of a media, of a corporate media, and not take it at face value. We almost need a kind of fifth estate. The media like to describe itself as the fourth estate, looking after everyone's interests and freedom of expression. But we need a fifth estate now. We need people who are going to understand how the media work and tell the public and support, as I say, programs like yours and other independent journalism, and to educate people in navigating through this wondrous thing we have called the internet. Because there is, you know, if you navigate through it, you can find facts and you can find truth. There is a propaganda war on at the moment, and they mustn't be allowed to win it.
And I'm sorry, I just have to, we can't finish this conversation. We have talked before about this, but it is not a surprise that both Julian Assange and Chelsea Manning are now locked down. This is, you know, I used to think the idea of the gates of the prison gates, the gates of perception, that was sort of a metaphor, but actually it's a reality. And these two people, you know, what can we say about them being behind bars now? For all of us, really, they're standing, and they've stood for the things that were that are really most important to all of us. You know, peace, the ability to live our lives in a safe way, the whole thing. That's what they're ultimately standing for, and they're in jail.
Yeah, and the crime they've committed, Dennis, is that Julian Assange, it seems, according to the authorities now, to the grand jury people, those who are drafting his extradition, that he tried to protect the anonymity of his source, Chelsea Manning. That is the most basic moral responsibility of a journalist. And every journalist, even those who've been perhaps long swayed by other mutated forms of journalism, understand that's true. That's why they're in prison, because Chelsea is in prison again, so that the she can be coerced, they hope. She can be coerced into somehow incriminating Julian Assange. He's in prison to be extradited, they hope, on a charge of protecting his source. I've been trying to do this all my career.
Oh, all right. Well, we will continue to talk. We appreciate John Pilger, the the dialogue and the reflection. And we will keep going on this. We will not forget. This is the open door for Julian Assange, free speech, and real courageous publishing. Please, John, be careful. We will be talking to you soon. And stay safe.
Thank you, Dennis. All the best to you.
All right. And you are listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. And I really, you know, this is the day that the Mueller report was released, and supposedly everything, all history was going to be changed. And there's this shock and dismay about the Attorney General, Mr. Barr. And it is what's shocking to me. Everybody's shocked because Mr. Barr is a deep partisan of Donald Trump. Whatever you think about the content, everybody's shocked that he is there and he is a stalwart for the president. Just remember when he was first Attorney General for Bush, the first, who everybody likes to call the real president, Bush the first hired Barr because Barr was willing to get rid of the Iran-Contra investigation. He was there to help Bush pardon the Iran-Contra criminals who, if they had unraveled their whole story, Bush 1 would have been in a jail cell with all of them. And Trump hires the same guy, and nobody is questioning that part of the issue in terms of pardons and all that kind of stuff. Because there is no context to history. There is no context to these stories that are fed to you in pieces. And oftentimes, I'm going to leave it right there. Again, there goes that traffic jam between my heart and my mind. My heart does go out to Chelsea Manning now, back in jail. This extraordinary being who became a woman in solitary confinement, transcended, ascended, and now they put her back in jail. I can barely take it. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Stay tuned. In Berkeley, I'm Dennis Bernstein. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Well, we turn our attention back to Russiagate now that the report has actually been turned over to the Attorney General. He's written four pages about it, and there's the battle going on now. Is Congress going to get the whole thing, part of the thing, whatever the thing is? There was a real problem underlying this thing called Russiagate, and that was apparently it really didn't happen, and it seems to be, and we have somebody who's going to tell us all about this. I could think of it as two things: a scheme by Hillary Clinton for trying to justify, and her people trying to justify, how the hell you could lose an election to Donald Trump. And maybe secondarily, it was a whole sort of conjuring to cover up all the terrible things that the Clintons did to undermine Bernie Sanders that would have made a lot more people a lot more angry. We're being joined by Stephen Kinzer. Stephen Kinzer is a longtime journalist. He is now a senior fellow at the Watson Institute for International and Public Affairs at Brown University. His books include Overthrow, America's Century of Regime Change from Hawaii to Iraq, and most recently the book is The True Flag, Theodore Roosevelt, Mark Twain, and the Birth of American Empire. I believe you used to write for the New York Times, right?
That was just a little 23-year parenthesis for me, yes.
I just wanted to throw that in. Okay, well, what do you think about my synopsis? Give us your overview. Did you ever believe that there was such a thing as Russiagate, that the Russians assisted Trump actively in defeating Clinton?
I don't think it was a decisive factor, but I think there's a lot of reasons why we wanted to believe that it was. One was what you mentioned. I think there is a kind of a desire on the part of the Clinton people to explain what happened. How could Clinton possibly have lost? So the idea that Hillary Clinton lost because she was highly repugnant to a large segment of American voters, and that Donald Trump tapped into outrage at the incestuous Washington clique that Hillary Clinton represents, that doesn't seem possible. So it has to be something else. There has to be some kind of an outside force. But I think there's also a larger background to our eagerness to believe that Russia did all of this to us. First of all, although it contradicts all geopolitical reality, Americans like to think of ourselves as a poor little weak country that everybody is attacking, and we're all alone out in the world, and giant forces are against us, and we're just trying to defend ourselves. That's an exact opposite of what's actually happening in the world, but I think it kind of makes everybody feel better to think that we're persecuted for supporting justice. Now, the Russiagate narrative was very powerful. It's a classic storyline, like every Western movie. You have a brute who comes in to a nice, peaceful place where people just want to live normal lives and wrecks it for them. This is the scenario that Russiagate fit into. For 2 years, we were bombarded with these reports about every new revelation, every bombshell, breaking news telling us about how Russia had crashed into our electoral system and seized control of it. Our narrative was not just that there was interference in the election, but that there's a hateful power out there in the world that's working relentlessly to steal from us Americans everything that's sacred in our democratic tradition and in our national soul. So we've built up Russia as this immense enemy. And when something happened in the United States that we didn't like, such as Donald Trump getting elected, seems so perfect to say, well, it was Russia that did this to us. So we took a few pieces of evidence and certainly some reality and inflated it wildly to the point where many Americans came to believe that the decisive factor in the recent presidential election was Russian intervention. That's not the case. I think that becomes clear in what we know from the Mueller report. I certainly hope that report is fully released, but from what we know and from what I think has slowly become clear, it's not going to say that Russia stole the election. And that's tremendously disappointing for many people inside the Beltway in Washington.
And it is amazing what people were willing to ignore, even as the commentators, you name it, went down the Russiagate line. I mean, the idea that this there was a senior person at the FBI and communicating with somebody at the Justice Department about one way or the other, we're going to stop Trump. And you think about the history of some of the folks who the corporate media really depended upon as their pundits. You name the former CIA, NSA, whatever director who had a history of lying. The whole thing became a fantastic myth that the American people bought. And it is now presents a danger, doesn't it?
Well, you're absolutely right that the so-called liberal media, which is caught up in Trump derangement syndrome, seized onto as heroes many of the people and the institutions that up until a few years ago, people were feeling as repressive parts of American government. I mean, I can remember when Mueller, now the great hero who was going out to prove everything about the evil about Russia, so we thought, was sitting in front of a congressional committee explaining how Saddam Hussein definitely had weapons of mass destruction and we had to go in and overthrow him. Suddenly, he became a hero. We're seeing these former FBI directors, in fact, the FBI itself and the CIA, being held up as the great defenders of American freedom and American democracy because they are defending us against Putin. It's really a dramatic turnaround, and the way some of these people who we were taught for a long time to detest have now suddenly been turned into heroes shows you how quickly the media can pivot. I think part of it goes back to our another syndrome, if you want to call it that. I call it enemy deprivation syndrome. After the end of the Cold War, we really didn't have anyone that hated us and anyone to hate. For a while, we were able to hate Islamic terror groups, but now, essentially, we're allied with them in places like Syria. So we don't hate them anymore. Russia has now come back to fill the role of the great enemy in the American mindset. And let me just try to spin this out as it must look from Moscow. If I were Putin and I found out that my chief of intelligence was doing nothing to sow dissent in the United States and was not trying to interfere, for example, in countries in Europe to try to weaken their commitments to NATO, I would fire him. The Russians cannot fight back against America on our terms. We have nuclear missiles within a few hundred meters of Russian soil. We have our soldiers conducting military maneuvers right on their borders. They can't do that. The Russians can never confront us with more tanks and more soldiers and better fighter planes. So they have to use other weapons. They're using hybrid warfare. They have to resist somehow. They are under intense pressure from the United States. So it just makes sense that the Russians would be looking for some kinds of ways to ease the pressure on them. There's really only two ways to fight the United States in the modern world. One is asymmetrical, and the other is stupid. Really, asymmetrical is the only way. So instead of us being outraged at Russia possibly purloining emails or posting memes on Facebook, we might ask ourselves, what are we doing that is pushing Russia to the point when they feel they need to defend themselves against our pressures?
Just to add a little more to the sort of the Russian perspective, what could we say about the kind of meddling that the United States participated in making sure that Yeltsin would be the pliable leader of the new Russia, which would be a good deal for U.S. businessmen and everything else about the USA?
It's absolutely true that the United States provided decisive assistance in a variety of ways that brought Yeltsin to power in Russia. Bill Clinton essentially fell in love with Yeltsin and wanted to do whatever we could to support him. We had Americans over there working on his campaign. We were providing official blessing to initiatives that he was proposing. Yeltsin wound up being the person more than anyone else who, from the Russian perspective, wrecked Russia and turned the whole country over to a clique of corrupt oligarchs, or, from the American perspective, the wonderful guy who liberated Russia from the ideas of using government for social welfare and brought it back into the neoliberal camp. So we are really the kings of election interference in the world, and Russia has only been one of the victims. You know, the very first major CIA campaign ever came just 1 year after the CIA was founded in 1947. We launched a major campaign to shape the result of the 1948 election in Italy. We wanted to guarantee that the Christian Democrats, who are our allies, would win. And this involved the sending of millions of letters from Italian Americans to their relatives back home, promoted by the CIA, telling them that Italy was going to lose all American aid if communists were brought into government. It involved all sorts of ways to influence the election inside of Italy. That was the beginning of a campaign and of a period in which we were the decisive factors in shaping Italian elections for the next 20 years. And we began using this tactic all over the world. Just to cite one example that I personally witnessed, I remember in Nicaragua, 1984, Daniel Ortega was running for president. We wanted to run a candidate against him. And a CIA officer met with a Nicaraguan economist in Washington to in a Vietnamese restaurant, of all places, if you like symbolism, and asked him, would you like to go back to Nicaragua and be our candidate for president against Daniel Ortega? He did. That was Arturo Cruz. He went back to Nicaragua at the request of the CIA, and the campaign unfolded just the way we wanted. We wanted to show that the election was a farce. And so we sent a candidate down there to run. And then shortly before the election, we told them, we want you to pull out. And we want you to stand up and say, the Sandinistas are brutal and oppressive. They're not allowing me to run a free campaign. I withdraw in protest. And that's what happened. So we also sought to use the Nicaraguan electoral process, not as a way to show ability of citizens to elect their leaders, but as part of a larger project aimed at destroying the Nicaraguan government. So manipulating elections is us. There's no country in the world that has intervened nearly so often in nearly as many elections in countries so far away from our own borders as the United States. Now we're getting a slight minor dose of our own medicine, and we're in outrage. I'd love to see us look in the mirror a little bit when we're trying to find out who's the real culprit for our messing around in elections in other countries.
And that mirror goes far back into history. I'm going to talk a little bit more about this because the point you're making now is so crucial in context for people understanding the nature of history and where this stuff comes from. We're speaking with Stephen Kinzer. Kinzer is a senior fellow at the Watson Institute for International and Public Affairs at Brown University. He's the author of a number of books and most recently the article, The Folly of Russiagate, which appears in the Boston Globe. Professor Kinzer, you also wrote another book, which sort of takes us back to where this policy that you're outlining now in so many clear and distinct and troubling ways. Did you write a book called Bitter Fruit about Guatemala? It sort of started there, or at least that was one of the markers in history that demonstrated the way in which the U.S. government would undermine, intercede, disrupt, overthrow, you name it.
It's true. At the beginning of the Eisenhower administration in 1953-54, the United States set off on a new way of trying to shape events in the world. So before World War II, we intervened the old-fashioned way. You just send troops and you land on the beach and you overthrow the guy. You take over the capital and you put your own guy in. After the Second World War, that wasn't possible anymore. There was a new factor in the world. That was the Red Army, the Soviet Union. If we land Marines on the beach in some country, there's nothing to guarantee that the Soviets won't do the same. And the next thing you know, we're in a confrontation that could spiral off into nuclear holocaust. So the United States needed another way to shape governments to our will. And that was covert action. Eisenhower was a tremendous supporter of covert action. So was his Secretary of State, John Foster Dulles, and Dulles's brother, Alan Dulles, who was the head of the CIA. So with Eisenhower's approval, they went out to try to overthrow legally elected governments. And in the space of the first 18 months after Eisenhower took office, they had overthrown two of them. So our first target in 1953 was the democratically elected government of Iran. Mohammad Mossadegh was overthrown in the summer of 1953 in a CIA coup, which resulted in bringing back the Shah, who went on to rule for 25 years without ever having a free election, and then was finally overthrown by the mullahs in 1979. We were so thrilled that we'd been able to destroy a democratic government in Iran, because that government was trying to nationalize its own wealth in the shape of oil, that we went on to do the same thing again less than a year later in Guatemala. Instead of oil, Guatemala had bananas, most of which were controlled by a big American corporation, United Fruit. Because the president of Guatemala, like the prime minister of Iran, was democratically elected, he had to respond to the will of his own people. And in both cases, the will of the Iranian people and the will of the Guatemalan people was, we need to take control of the resource that is the most valuable thing we have and the only chance we have to earn money to develop our country. the profits from those resources cannot go to foreign corporations forever. So we went in and overthrew both of those governments. They were both legally elected governments. And if we had refrained from intervening, there would have been another election and somebody else would have come in and democracy would have continued to flower. But we intervened to crush democracy because it produced results that we didn't like. And we have continued to do that over decades. Now we're outraged to try to imagine that the purity of our democracy, as we like to imagine it, has been sullied by outside forces. Now it's true. Our democracy has clearly eroded in just in the space of our, I like to think, relatively short lifetimes. Our country is clearly less democratic. Our political system is clearly less open than it was when we were kids. But that's not to do with any foreign country. There are enemies of democracy who are attacking the integrity of our elections. But that has to do with gerrymandering. It has to do with voter suppression. It has to do with a whole series of campaigns that we Americans have waged against ourselves. It's not outsiders who have perverted our democracy. It's true our democracy has weakened, but it's too easy to say, as we love to do, it's all Russia. Some evil force did it to us. It's a lot more complicated and more honest to ask what we ourselves have done to tear down the essence of our democratic system.
Boy, do I wish I had had you as a history professor. I want to draw this to a close this way. First of all, we're going to talk for a moment about what happened with Julian Assange. But to conclude this, let's go back to the title of your article, The Folly of Russiagate. And that folly can be profound, serious. And you mentioned the brink of nuclear war where, well, you know, the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists is back. We're getting closer to midnight, and it's based on the latest Russiagate frenzy. You want to talk about that?
The denial that we are in America about our own responsibility for the decline of our democracy might not be so dangerous if it was just adding another layer of pathos to the bizarre political circus that we're living through. But it's worse than that. It has a global implication. Our panic and our accusations against Russia and our sense that Russia is a demonic force that hates us and is trying to undermine and steal from us leads to something that's very dangerous. This delusion leads us to believe that Russia is our irredeemable enemy. And if you believe that, there's no point in negotiating with Russia. We should not be negotiating with them to reduce tensions in Europe, for example. We should not be negotiating with them to limit nuclear weapons. We should not be negotiating with them to try to calm the Middle East. You cannot negotiate with them at all because they're our hateful enemy. This is much worse than just coming up with the fantasy or the argument they interfered in our election, or no, they didn't. This is something that's profound for the future of the world. And actually, the dogma that Russians hate us and are out to crush us and are out to destroy our freedom is more dangerous to our security than anything that happened during the last presidential election campaign.
All right, that's Professor Stephen Kinzer. Professor Kinzer, I want to ask you about Julian Assange. He seems to have been abandoned by many people who should be supporting him in the world of journalism. I think I remember your former paper, the New York Times, the Washington Post. I can name the list of every major news organization in the world that worked with Julian Assange and used the material in various important ways, but he doesn't seem to have a lot of friends now as they dragged him out of the embassy. You want to talk about why it's important to pay attention to what's happening here and what it might mean?
I actually think that Assange performed a service. I understand it was very embarrassing for the United States, and I remember Hillary Clinton, as Secretary of State, having to go on what she called her apology tour to go to all the countries that felt insulted because the truth of what they told us came out in print. But I actually learned a lot. I think the world learned a lot from many of the documents that WikiLeaks released. The people who run governments and other powerful institutions never like their secrets to be aired in public. People like me that are in journalism are supposed to be tormenting them and revealing their secrets when we can. So I would like to see Julian Assange, just like Edward Snowden, welcomed to the United States and asked to try to add to our understanding of the world rather than to demonize them as enemies. I know the United States has been intensely eager to arrange a prosecution of Assange. I think there's probably a secret indictment against him in the United States, which we're going to be finding out about pretty soon. Really, I think the campaign against him is largely based on a sense of revenge, a sense of anger. People in power in the United States are the specific people who were embarrassed and humiliated when Assange's WikiLeaks cables revealed things that they had really said and things that they had really done. We like to get back at people like that. And we have this syndrome that we don't want to get humiliated or punished without being able to strike back. And Assange sitting in that embassy was a kind of a provocation to us. In a way, it's a smaller version of the way we look at Iran. I think one reason we're so frustrated with Iran is we feel like they gave us a real blow with the hostage crisis 40 years ago, and we never really got them back for that. We're still eager to even the score. It's the same thing with Assange. He did something that people in power felt was bad for us, and they're not giving up until they can laugh at him and say, we got the last laugh. And they will in a shorter period, but if you look over the long term, I sometimes wonder who really is going to have the last laugh.
You know, I think when I look back on history that the extent of the brutality, the level of the brutality, is in direct proportion to the courage and to the truth of the moment that was told. You know, so here we have Julian Assange and Chelsea Manning both in jail for what? For releasing of the video that became collateral murder, that demonstrated that it wasn't a document, it wasn't 300 pages, it was a video of the slaughter of civilians and a joyful response to the killing and the sort of chain of command. So it was, if you will, killer for the policy. And so they're being punished.
I would add that, what we're doing in our outrage about Russiagate is saying it was really bad for Russia to be saying things about us and things about Hillary Clinton and things about the United States that weren't true. People shouldn't be saying things that aren't true. And you might argue that's a point. Well, so what are we angry at Julian Assange for? For telling things that were true. It's not that he was spreading lies. What we're so angry about him at is that he was spreading the truth. And we find that the most offensive of any crime.
Amazing. Well, I think about that old saying, truth has few friends, and those fewer suicides. I hope it's not true, but I keep thinking of Gandhi and Martin Luther King, and now in this context, Chelsea Manning, and looking for a different world, Stephen Kinzer.
Well, they say only the good die young, and every time I see a picture of Henry Kissinger at the age of 90 still giving interviews and going to fancy dinners in New York, I think of the truth of that motto.
We've been speaking with Stephen Kinzer again. He's a senior fellow at the Watson Institute for International and Public Affairs at Brown University. His latest piece in the newspaper is The Folly of Russiagate. He wrote that for the Boston Globe. It has been a pleasure and really enlightening to speak with you, Professor.
Remember his fiercely honest writing from Gaza? Max Blumenthal, author of Goliath and Republican Gomorrah, is now coming to Berkeley with a blazing new book, The Management of Savagery, How America's National Security State Fueled the Rise of Al-Qaeda, ISIS, and Donald Trump. This is a thoroughly damning indictment of our bipartisan national security apparatus. Max will be hosted by Nora Barros-Friedman of the Electronic Intifada and Flashpoints. This KPFA benefit will be Thursday evening, April 25, at First Congregational Church, 2345 Channing Way in Berkeley. There's wheelchair access. Tickets at brownpapertickets.com and supportive indie bookstores. As for Max Blumenthal, April 25th, don't miss it.
You're listening to 94.1 KPFA, 89.3 KPFB in Berkeley, 88.1 KFCF in Fresno, 97.5 K248BR in Santa Cruz, and online at kpfa.org.